Welcome to this episode of Career Conversations. My name is Siobhan Murphy, one of the careers advisors in DCU. Today we are going to unpack the future of work, what we need to know about it, and critically, what steps we can take to help ourselves in those transitions. So joining me today is David Collings, who is a professor of HRM and associate dean for research at DCU Business School. He has been a visiting professor at a number of international universities, including King's College London and Cornell University, where he was actually a Fulbright scholar. His research focus is on talent management, staffing, and the future of work, and he has been named as one of the most influential thinkers in HRM on four occasions by HR Magazine. Also, Brian Harney, who is an Associate Professor of Strategy in HRM at DCU Business School. He's a former Programme Director of the award-winning Masters in HRM and plays a leading role in the school's SME Management Development Programmes. Brian is currently a Principal Investigator of GetMe3, a €1 million funded project exploring entrepreneurial talent management. So you're both extremely welcome, and I'm going to start off with yourself, David. Firstly, what is the future of work?
Hi, Siobhan. Well, thanks a million. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm looking forward to the conversation with yourself and Brian this afternoon. Yeah, the future of work, it's a really interesting topic, and we see a lot of hype around the future of work. So it's interesting to drill down into it a little bit and see what it actually is and what it looks like. This is a question that a number of our colleagues in the business school have been looking at from different perspectives over the last number of years. And together with my colleague, John McMacken, it's an area I've done a reasonable amount of research in. And I guess one of the key takeaways for us is that the idea and even the language of the future of work suggests that this is some distant reality that we don't really need to worry about now because it's not going to happen for a period of time. But actually, our research, which mostly happened pre the current COVID crisis, suggested that the future of work is already here. And I think there's a greater realization across the board that the future of work is here in many ways. And there's no doubt but the current COVID situation has certainly accelerated trends in the future of work. So I guess the kind of things that are coming through in our research of indicative of what those changes might look like and what the future include things like artificial intelligence. So we see artificial intelligence playing a much greater role in organizations already. You know, one way of thinking about it in context is if we look at how much organizations globally spend on artificial intelligence. In 2016, that was only $1.8 billion US dollars. By 2025, the expectation is that number will increase to $59 billion. So a phenomenal increase in the investment in artificial intelligence systems and organizations. And, you know, again, one of the things we kind of assume about the future of work is the jobs that are at risk are low-skill jobs. But we can see the likes of artificial intelligence impacting on very highly skilled jobs too. So some research recently looked at cancer detection and how pathologists versus artificial intelligence fared in terms of identifying cancers in tests. And the numbers are fairly staggering. So pathologists looked at the results, the error rate was about 3.5%. When AI did it on its own, the error rate was 7.5%. But interesting, when we combined the results from the pathologists and the AI, the error rate fell to just 0.5%. So very significant improvements in the quality of those decisions when people and technology work together. So I think the first trend is around artificial intelligence and not necessarily replacing jobs, but in a lot of instances, that interface between technology and people. The second key trend we kind of identify is around robotics. And again, just looking at, you know, some of the trends there. So this is an area where the spend is also increasing. So, you know, the spend this year alone is predicted to be about $188 billion. And that's up 100% since 2016. So the trajectory is very, very steep. We see organizations like Amazon significantly increasing the number of robots they use in their packaging centers, and in many instances those reduce their labor costs by 20%. I think, you know, the other thing we see that's very clear is the pace of change is far quicker than it has been in the past in terms of work and skills. So a great example of this, some research looked at the half-life of the skills of an engineer. So by the half-life, we mean how long it takes for half the knowledge that I get through my engineering degree to become obsolete. And 100 years ago, that half-life could have been 30 to 35 years. So it would have taken 30 to 35 years for half of what I know to become obsolete. My recent estimates is that half-life might be as little as 3.5 to 7 years. So the pace of change is so much quicker than it was in the past.
So with that pace of change, like, what does that present then for the individual, you know, when the half-life of your degree, no matter what degree it is, possibly, you know, is already shorter and will become significantly shorter? So what's the impact of that?
Yeah, for sure. So I think we certainly can't expect that if we do go to university, or even if we do an apprenticeship, or whatever way we develop our skills, we can't expect that we leave that program, come out the other end with a skill set that's going to enable us for our entire career. The reality is that we're going to require a constant cycle of upskilling, in some instances reskilling, as we move through our careers and technology advances and the nature of work advances. And fundamentally, where we have the potential to add value in organizations changes. So that one and done model of education is certainly something from the past. And really the focus for us all now is to continue to keep ourselves relevant and to continue to update our skill set so that we can continue to be employable and in demand in the labor market.
And just to come back to your point about robotics and, I suppose, the heavy use of automation. Now, we're very used to seeing automation perhaps in the car industry for a long number of years, and in food manufacturing, you know, so many instances where we actually, you know, we do know automation is quite high and will get higher. I suppose it just often begs the question that around the, I suppose, the tension between innovation, productivity, and then if there is less human beings there, you know, isn't around that, you know, how do we move on then to more increased levels of innovation, you know, when there's actually a lack of human beings as part of the process?
Yeah, I think, again, with a lot of these trends that we see in the workplace and in the world in general, we kind of tend to think in extremes, and, you know, the complete replacement of human labor with robotics or the like. In many instances, that's not likely to be the case. I think, you know, what's likely to happen is we see a greater interface between people and technology. And we can see that in all kinds of sectors, you know, so surgery now is highly automated, and very skilled surgeons work hand in glove with technology in terms of completing procedures. In the law profession, we're seeing increasing automation in some of the roles there. So it's certainly not the case that technology will replace humans. I think what we will see is a lot more of work being augmented by technology. So I think your point is well made. If we go too far down the road, then that's likely to create some challenges. But the reality is we're probably going to land somewhere in between.
And it's funny you should say about the law is, and I know from machine learning is very much going to become a feature of the law profession, you know, to help it do the research, you know, for on behalf of the solicitors, or the solicitors and barristers doing it for themselves. And I've also seen, you know, a kind of new terminology coming up around, you know, where this interface is actually happening. So one of the newer roles I've seen as legal engineer. So it's somebody with a legal background and software engineering together, or some components of that. So definitely we're getting new types of jobs, you know, and certainly there's definitely new names emerging to help us explain and understand that aspect of it. Just might bring yourself in, Brian, now at this point. One of the things that we do hear about is I think we've all kind of wrapped our heads around that whole concept of a job for life, that it's all but gone. And certainly for some people that's great, and for some people that's a very much a challenge. But we're also hearing about different ways of income generation, and I suppose we're also hearing a lot around this phrase, the gig economy. So firstly, can you explain what the gig economy is and maybe talk us through where we are currently with it and where it's likely to move towards?
Yeah, thanks very much, Siobhan. It's great to have this opportunity to talk with yourself and Dave. I think this picks up on one of Dave's points about the future of work, which obviously is different arms, one of which is another one that gets a lot of media attention and in some ways is overstated and overplayed and oversimplified, is this idea of gig work and the gig economy. And I suppose in its most simplistic form, the idea that in the past, firms used to acquire your services as an employee, and that would be, as you said, over the longer term. And they're now moving into a mode of transaction where they're moving from acquisition of talent to accessing talent. And that can be for much shorter periods of time as a much more transactional relationship. So the idea that we're looking at the firm as the basis of everything in the economy, we're now seeing a more fragmented workplace. And I suppose where that's become most obvious and has become into sharp relief as a result of Corona is in the context of frontline service work, where we've got people who are now in what are the equivalent of essential jobs. But we're not quite sure, and it's coming apparent, that the protections for those that are self-employed and their ability to sustain income in, for example, this moment of crisis differs from your, in inverted commas, traditional employee. So while on one hand, gig gives flexibility and independence, which are its huge advantages, on the other side of the equation, it gives huge precariousness as a worker. So that uncertainty in terms of demand, that uncertainty when things have changed. That said, I think the gig economy is hugely variable. So we tend to think of service and front-end workers, but actually there's a huge high-end component to the gig economy. And that can be firms needing information at the front end of a project, needing ideas up front and bringing in tech expertise or people with sufficient experience or previous experience in a domain, leveraging that experience and then cascading that own learning within their organization themselves. So, It's not simply a low or high-end phenomenon. It goes right across the economy, and it's used as levers for different purposes.
So in some sense, if I'm picking you up right, Brian, what we kind of thought about some sort of individual consultancy services or, you know, maybe we talked about contract work, you know, that is now becoming part of that gig economy phrase.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, it's open to multiple interpretations. And some organizations are only getting to the stage where they're considering to what extent are we dealing with contract or gig workers? To what extent do we have specific policies around engagement with gig workers? What happens when our knowledge transfers across the organization boundaries? How do we monitor the performance of external workers? And I think it's really interesting. We talk to a lot of HR managers, and they're saying the key challenge was always to get managers to delegate down. The skill for the future is going to be to delegate outwards. To what extent, when you're working on specific tasks, can you draw on external expertise, manage that expertise, but still bring the learning back to your team and the organization? And it's a huge challenge going forward for organizations and individuals.
And what would be your own sense of the best approaches on that?
I think it's to have clarity around why someone is being hired, what the purpose is, what the value add is, and the nature of the contract. And it's to have maybe an organization-wide understanding of that, the extent to which we want to engage with this, what our policies are, what our extent of our engagements are, and even the nature of the contracts that we're giving people, and how we monitor all that. So it's accessing a skill base that isn't of the firm, it's outside of the firm, and therefore there needs to be sort of a change in the way we apply HR to assess and monitor that.
And possibly even a wider understanding and a conceptual understanding of working in a team, that the team, you know, you may not be actually a co-worker in the strict sense of the word, you know, how we traditionally viewed people that we worked along with.
Totally. It's a really good point. And I think that that has, it depends on the nature of work. It depends on the nature of the project, the knowledge intensity required. If you're going in for a specific technical component that you can introduce something, plug and play and leave, that's fine. But if you're embedded in, say, dealing with a client problem that involves interaction, teamwork, knowledge sharing, you're right, there's a socialization there, and that socialization is going to be different. And organizations need to think about the components. And also for those traditionally in an organization, what is the implication, what are the expectations of having continuous external people coming in and out of an equation? And on a broader level, on societal terms, there's big conversations around protection of self-employed workers and even the status of a self-employed worker and what that implies in terms of the relief you might receive, particularly in crisis situations as we're seeing now.
Brilliant. And just bringing yourself back in, David, so you've identified those big picture things around robotics and automation, but what are the kind of the skills that will be needed in the future?
Yeah, so to the point you made earlier, Siobhan, in terms of some of the new job titles you see coming through, I think the reality is that what we're, those folks that are likely to be most marketable moving forward are people who have skills at the interface of the softer or transversal skills, things like project management, like learning agility, like leadership skills, like teamwork. They're still highly, highly valued by organizations. But if you also have some expertise in some of the technical side, so, you know, we see skills like machine learning in high demand, skills like artificial intelligence in a broader sense, broader digital skills. So those skills that are at the interface of technology and the transversal or softer skills, I think, are going to be hugely in demand. But it's also important to remember, you know, we see a lot of demand for skills like critical thinking. So they're developed in courses that we would never necessarily associate with high-end companies or technical companies. They're considered more academic type skills. You know, people like, you know, philosophers, mm-hmm. and the like, you know, those types of critical thinking skills are likely to be hugely in demand as well. But again, I would say if you come through a program from that kind of a tradition and can kind of package those skills with some sort of technical skills, then you're going to be in a really sweet spot in terms of your marketability to organizations.
And if I often see with some of the students now, and I think that's one of the, I suppose, the areas that I have seen a huge change in, that that students are very looking both within and outside their study, you know, for their learning. There is an awful lot of short courses you can do, even down mm-hmm. to YouTube videos. There's LinkedIn Learning. There's MOOCs. There's so many things. We're probably, you know, overwhelmed with options in some respect. But Brian, maybe just talk to a little bit about this whole concept of micro credentials and maybe how they can be those the steps on the bridge for people.
Yeah, and I think it very much links with that fast pace of change and need to upskill and reskill. And I suppose one skill that I'd add to what Dave mentioned there is sort of the ability to learn. Mm-hmm. Isn't something that we necessarily think about, but is actually a fundamental underpinning. So if learning is the basis of advantage, how do people learn? And we do see more pressure for the individual, that the responsibility, and it comes both ways, because people don't necessarily respond well to the organization telling them what they should learn. People like to learn something on the back of an interest or value add to them. So there's a bit of a sales proposition on that side. But in terms of continuous learning, I don't think there's ever been a greater opportunity for people to hone their skill sets. And I think as well, and this picks up on what Dave was saying, practical problems don't respect disciplinary boundaries. So there's the idea that immersing yourself in a holistic skill set. There's that famous line from Steve Jobs, you know, who said, you know, I dropped out of college to drop back in. Because he wanted to explore the arts, he wanted to have an interdisciplinary education. And I think For micro skills, this gives people an opportunity, micro credentials, to explore domains beyond and stretch their comfort zone, if you like, to explore related skills, which mightn't on the first hand seem immediately obvious in terms of their benefits, but actually provide a new form of mindset to individuals.
So I suppose just to explain to people about micro-credentials are quite a short course. It might be just honing in on a particular skill. And then obviously, usually with micro-credentials, you can build on and out with them. But they're, I suppose, they're, for want of a better word, they're a great taster course. And if you need further development, it's up to you then to pursue them. Just to bring yourself back in there, Dave, what do you think the challenges are? You know, there is a sense... You quite rightly said it. The future work is already here. We have adapted thus far, but what would you see the early indicators that we will continue to adapt well, or is there already alarm bells there?
So the alarm bells that came through in our research were that organizations were probably across the board not putting enough emphasis internally on developing the skills for the future work. So a good percentage of organizations in our research recognized that there was some challenges coming down the road for skills. But I think fewer than 3 in 10 of those organizations were actively focused on developing skills for the future work. And that's understandable because obviously, you know, for any organization, there's always a tension between managing the short term and the priorities of the here and now, with looking at things that appear to be far in the future and planning for those. And we also know, you know, we've seen kind of, particularly right now, we see huge pressures on organizations to manage in the here and now. So I think to a point that Brian mentioned earlier, you know, there's a lot more responsibility on individuals to drive their own learning now. And I think that's probably the biggest thing to be aware of, that organizations are not, there's no guarantee that organizations are going to map out your learning and development journey for you to the same degree that was the case in the past. And for a number of reasons, one of which, you know, we now have lots of different entry routes into organizations. So people are coming in at lots of different levels with lots of different capabilities. That's a bit of a change from the past when, you know, that jobs for life model that somebody mentioned earlier, where, you know, I join as a graduate or from a leaving cert and I work my way up through the organization and everybody that progressed went through a similar development program. Now we've people coming in with lots of different skills and at lots of different levels. So that kind of single model doesn't work for people. And I think Brian is absolutely right. I think, you know, we don't necessarily have a situation where individuals want to be told what they need to learn and how they need to learn. So we see a shift to that kind of just-in-time learning, just for me and just now. So I'm learning in the moment as I need skills and capabilities. So it's really the importance of that individual ownership of development and that individual focus on keeping on top of one's skills. And, you know, coming back to the conversation on the gig economy earlier, you know, we have seen some research that suggests that contractors, particularly high skilled contractors in the gig economy, are often upskilling themselves more quickly and to a better degree than is even happening in organizations, because they recognize that they are almost entrepreneurs and they need to keep on top of new trends and new technologies to keep themselves marketable.
Okay, and it just kind of brings me in when you said about taking ownership of your own development and your own learning. I suppose for us in the career service, or those people who are in the career guidance profession, I suppose we're big advocates of having career management as a core skill that people build up a competency with over their lifespan. And I'm using that word lifespan right up to including how to manage yourself in retirement. I think career guidance has been traditionally very heavily associated with second level and to obviously third level as well. But realistically, to deal with the level of change that we are currently experiencing and changes that we already know will happen, now how quickly they will happen, to the depth that we'll have, and that will all have to unfold. But just to give our listeners a bit of an insight, that if you're, you know, sitting at home or in the car, having a walk, listening to this, well, that's great that, you know, all of this is happening. But like, what will I do if I need help? You know, so if you're thinking about booking a career guidance appointment with anybody, obviously in the university or in private practice, I suppose the type of things that might, trigger you into booking an appointment would be that you are having difficulty writing the next chapter of your life. Or when you look maybe 10 years down forward, you don't see yourself or your role existing, or you see the role maybe fundamentally shifting so 360 that you no longer recognise it. So that could be a trigger. That if you feel actually quite stuck in your career, you know, and you can feel stuck at any stage of life, you can get through many transitions in life and then suddenly, you know, get very stuck, and that's quite okay. That what you're doing now, you know, in your career now, is not going to resemble anything like what it will in a few years' time. So that kind of thing is just going to change so fundamental. And you don't see something else out there that you would actually like to do. So there'd be the kind of typical things. So obviously a skilled career guidance practitioner will help you get unstuck and work with you and help you co-construct with you the next chapter of your life. The other thing that can actually trigger this is an actual life event. So those of you who are, you know, at home and listening to this during a life event such as coronavirus or whatever stage of things that are actually happening, it could be bereavement. They can trigger, emotions around what you want to do the rest of your life, including your career. Other things like redundancy obviously is a huge triggering event for people. If the company, there's a merger and acquisition, that can also be a triggering event. So they're all the type of times in your life that maybe your own internal resources are just a little bit too stretched, and they're the type of times in your life that it's really useful to seek out a skilled career guidance practitioner, and they will help you work on that and get you back into managing your own career, managing your own learning, managing your own career development. So I just want to, have you any thoughts on that yourselves there and what I've said, or you can feel free to argue with me. I'm open to that.
No, I think what you said there, Siobhan, it is a great resource. And when I was talking about the gig economy, we're thinking about firms as network orchestrators, but we can also think of individuals as network orchestrators. And basically what that means is you're the sum of the people that you interact with. So you need to think about, where are the best places where I can get resources, information, supports? And in the university context, obviously the career services, we're seeing a lot in organizations on mentoring, reverse mentoring. I know DCU has a fantastic reverse mentoring program ongoing at the moment, peer coaching, even accountability partners. So if you're looking at the moment, even going back to micro-credentials, you may look at it on a website and go, that's really fascinating, and then you get distracted. But if you say to a friend or a colleague or a family member, I'm going to do that course and I'm going to have it done within 2 weeks' time, and why don't you do one and we'll compare notes? And if you've got that sense of an accountability, someone working with you, a little bit of an end goal, because the difficulty with these relative to, say, the university, traditional university system, is they don't have an automatic end deadline. It's up to you to manage it. And for all of us, that can be very difficult. So the more we can embed some support, some network into how we are upskilling, upgrading, learning, relearning, unlearning, I think the easier that is or becomes.
And I know from ourselves, from a career management point of view, that I suppose the two big components I personally would advocate, and I know other colleagues would as well, is the two meta competences that we would talk about in career management skills is knowing how to change, and critically, when to change. So it's kind of, you know, moving it at the right time with the right know-how. Okay, and there, that's where we would always like to work with our students on, is building up that type of knowledge about themselves, knowing themselves enough and their own identity enough to help make that happen. What about yourself, Dave? Any thoughts about career management and that whole, how that can actually really lend help and assistance to individuals and then obviously by default organisations?
Yeah, the one thing that struck me that I think probably doesn't get enough discussion is confidence. Mm-hmm. and even things like the imposter syndrome. So how many of us feel, God, somebody's going to catch me out someday? And that holds us back from exploring new opportunities or even applying for a promotion or moving forward in our career. And those kind of issues can be influenced by gender, for example. So there's a lot of research that looks at females when it comes to applying for jobs or applying for promotions. And that research suggests that a female candidate is unlikely to apply for a job unless she feels she ticks all the boxes. Whereas a male candidate is more likely to say, "Ah, sure, I'll have a go and I'll chance it." And apply for something even when they don't meet all of the criteria or even relatively few of them. So sometimes those kind of conversations are really important in terms of, you know, sense checking one's own perception of where they're at and providing, I guess, a degree of confidence to put oneself forward for higher level roles or for different roles. And sometimes for many people, we have, you know, people we can confide with and people in our network, you know, good managers or former bosses who are good mentors to us or our parents or our family members or whoever. But for lots of people, that's not necessarily the case. And, you know, I think it's really important that in those contexts, people do recognize that there are professionals out there who can help you to evaluate where you're at and how you're profile is likely to look relative to others who might put themselves forward for the role. And I think that's a really important consideration too.
I really love that what you said about the imposter syndrome. Obviously, us in the career service have only after starting this podcast, so serious, so we're definitely feeling the imposter syndrome. And I suppose we're also very conscious. We've had some help from some of our communication students and things like that, but obviously we're remoting at the moment. And definitely, I'm sure when they're listening to me and some of the things that I've done and the mistakes I've made on the editing and everything like that, I'm sure they're throwing their eyes up to heaven. But we took the view that we were going to model the way and say, listen, we don't have to get it right before we start anything. We have to show that we're flexible, we're adaptable, we begin things we don't know where we're going to end up with, and we're going to learn on the way. So, you know, whereas before there might have been, you know, it would be so easy to kind of say, no, we need a professional, you know, training on it and so on and so forth. And we've just kind of said, no, we need to show students that we need to put ourselves in totally out of our comfort zone and do projects like this that we're finding tough ourselves to actually get on top of. I also thought you musicked my ears about the gender differences. We do point this out to both men and women when we speak to them about applying for a job. So my rule of thumb, and for what it's worth to the listeners, is 30% of that job description, that's too little maybe to throw an application in. Try and get maybe 65% is the sweet spot. When we're looking at job descriptions, they write them to attract a wide pool of talent. So therefore, you do not have to meet all of the criteria, but you would want to be meeting the kind of the essence of the job description. So you don't want to be too busy and, you know, putting in applications for things you absolutely cannot get. You know, you can't apply to be a doctor if you don't have, you know, you don't have the right qualifications. There is absolutely essential criteria on applications. But it's just to also kind of that if you can demonstrate to an employer that you're worth considering and being brought forward to the next stage, that's all you're responsible for doing. So definitely, I would absolutely agree with you. When we work sometimes with female students, they're being way too hard on themselves. Just want to, I suppose, I'm sorry, I'm going to pop this question up at you. One of the things that I have learned through my work with careers is that when people share their own career stories, that can be very, very useful to other people. So they see you both now, and you're both in academic careers, but you, at what point in your lives did that all emerge for you? And it can be really, really useful to know a little bit more about how you ended up to where you are now. So if you don't mind, David, maybe just letting us know just a little bit about how you started off in life and your career, and maybe just a couple of the key moments there that you kind of felt, whether it was a bit of luck or opportunity, it brought you to where you are now.
Yeah, you're putting me on the spot there.
I know, but isn't it great for you? Isn't it good for you?
Yeah. No, I think my route into academia was very much unplanned and organic. I've yet to meet a 10-year-old child when you ask them what they want to be, and they say, I want to be a university professor. So that certainly wasn't the case for me. To be honest, what happened for me was I had done a placement as part of my undergraduate degree and was offered a position in a company at the end of the placement. And the company ended up shutting down their Irish operation. It was a multinational company. So I was then left in the middle of the summer that I graduated with nothing. I hadn't applied in the milk round, and I had done nothing else. So I did a master's degree, and I had I was very lucky in my master's. I worked with Paddy Gunigal and Mike Morley at the University of Limerick, who kind of took me under their wing and encouraged me to do a PhD. And again, I kind of fell into it, and I wasn't 100% sure. And again, things just worked out. You know, I was very lucky. I got my first job in the university, my first job in the University of Sheffield, and worked with some amazing people there. And continued to build, and had a couple of lucky breaks over the years. Came back to Ireland, to anyway Galway, for a number of years, and again worked with some great people there and had some, you know, good opportunities. And then the opportunity for the professorship came up in DCU about 8 years ago at this stage. And again, I've never looked back. It's, you know, we've a fantastic group in my area in the business school, and fantastic colleagues across the university. Very lucky to have a dean and a president who are very supportive of the research we do. And you know, it's just been a lot of work. It's a lot of luck, and you know, obviously I've worked hard, but I've been lucky to meet and get to work with some great people who I've learned a lot from. And you know, I'm very grateful to all of those people. But it certainly wasn't a clearly mapped out plan. You know, it just happened organically, I'll be quite honest.
Well, I often find is that when you look back through the narrative retrospectively, you can see the step and how that step led to that step. You know, and it looks quite logical. But when you're on that first step, I suppose it's just to encourage your listeners, you know, we don't always know, but that's okay. You know, you just do the next right best step for you, as you clearly had to do each and every time. And that brought you on then to where you are today. So just yourself, Brian, maybe you might share with us your history here.
I think it's a great exercise, Siobhan. It's something we do actually with our SMEs when we have them in, is to reflect on the company history. I'm also reading a book at the moment for the big issue, and it's Letters to Your Younger Self.
Oh, yeah.
So I think as an exercise, and to hear other people much more important than us, is really interesting. But the message is the same, I suppose. It was more accidental and learning on the go, as most careers are. When I was in school, my uncle was an entrepreneur, and I worked with him for a number of years in his family business. And that got me interested in business. I was always interested in writing. After my undergrad degree, I applied to do a journalism degree. Of course, I'd no records to show them, no writing in papers. I'd won a few essay competitions, but I'd no evidence of any interest in journalism. So I didn't get that master's. On the back of that decision, I decided I just needed a change. So I moved out of Dublin, went down to NUI Galway to do a master's in strategy and people management. And like Dave, and like most people in their career, you meet some amazing people who will give you a foot up and help you. And I met some wonderful people in Galway who encouraged me to get funding to do a PhD in Cambridge, which I completed eventually, and was doing a guest lecture for someone in DCU, and they happened to say to me, we've a job and the deadline's tomorrow. And until that moment, my head wasn't even in the space for looking for jobs. And on the back of that, offering to do that guest lecture, which I volunteered to do, I heard about that job opportunity, applied, and here I am 11 years later.
And that's what I'm always saying to people is sometimes it's the opportunities are out there, but you have to have the blinkers off to see them as, you know, an opportunity. Now, we don't know any opportunity. You took an opportunity to do a guest lecture spot. May or may not have led to anything, but you put yourself in the way of it is really, I suppose, what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I think so. And as you say, when you reflect back, a lot of my work now is, this is all retrospective, a lot of my work now is with SMEs. And when I think about why that is the case, it's from working with my uncle. And I only realized that a few years ago.
Yeah, and we don't always see it in the moment. Now, just one last thing each, one last question each. You know, you can give me more than one top tip, but I suppose just for any listener today, and this is actually being recorded on the 29th of April. We're still in Corona territory. So sometimes we make really good decisions because, you know, of these unusual type of circumstances in our lives, and sometimes we don't. So it's to try and match off and take ourselves out of that coronavirus temporarily as well, and just say in general, what would be your top tip for anybody, you know, I suppose really trying to take on this concept of the future of work, David?
So it kind of picks up on the conversation that you just had with Brian on the last question. And just two things came to mind. So I'm going to not answer your question and give you two things. The first is, you know, don't let people tell you you can't do things. So Brian mentioned writing and liking writing. I had some amazing teachers in secondary school, but I always remember one teacher told me that I couldn't write, that I wrote like I spoke, and that wasn't a good way to write. And I've gone on to edit 12 books and write, I don't know, 100 papers or whatever it is. And people often comment on my writing as being something that the real strength of my skill set. So the first thing I'd say is, you know, don't let people tell you you can't do something. If you care about something and you want to pursue something, pursue it. And linked to that, it's very aligned with what you've been just saying there, Siobhan. Luck is when preparation meets opportunity. That's how I think about luck. And I've no doubt that I've been lucky many, many times in my career, but I've also pushed the door open and gone through it. So if you put in the work and you're ready when an opportunity comes up, then you just need to grasp that opportunity and go for it. And I know that sounds like kind of like apple pie and you know, all of those kind of things, but I do genuinely believe those two things. Like I always remember that teacher telling me I couldn't write, and I didn't take that much notice of it at the time, but as I reflect on how my career, my life has evolved, writing is such a huge part of my life now and my job. It's I do it as much as I do anything else, and apparently I'm pretty reasonable at it, and genuinely that kind of putting yourself in a position that opportunities come up and grabbing those opportunities is really what it's all about. And, you know, we all have that imposter syndrome. We all think at times, you know, we're punching above our weight, but, you know, just do your best and be honest and be you.
Yourself, Brian?
I suppose, and again, this might sound a bit apple pie, but it's to take everything as a learning opportunity, and probably something it's difficult to appreciate, but that everybody fails and everybody, so luck does come from that effort and resilience, and it's about thinking about learning from your successes. Why did that work in that particular context? But also, equally if not more beneficial learning is for why did that go wrong? What might be able to do different? What could I improve on? And I think particularly now in the sort of Corona situation as well is an opportunity for people to reflect on what they've learned, what they've done differently, what's worked. And that's true for individuals and for organizations. And there's a huge learning opportunity from this and a way to differentiate yourself on the back of that learning.
Okay, listen, I'm going to finish up today. I think I've learned loads. I've really, really enjoyed talking to you both. And I hope our listeners also find it very, very useful. Thank you so much for your time.